Welcome to MarsCast, a podcast from Mid-America Reform Seminary, where our faculty members address all things theological and cultural through a Reformed lens. I'm your host, Jared Luchborg. Well, I'm here back with Dr. Alan Strange, Professor of Church History and Apologetics here at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, here on the campus of the seminary to talk once again about church history, specifically moving more into the realm of medieval church history. Dr. Strange, thank you for joining me again.
It's my pleasure, as always, to be here, Jared, with you and your very fine listeners.
Dr. Strange, we're moving into the territory now here of Islam and the Crusades. If you've tuned into our prior episodes, we touched a little bit about this. Dr. Strange, last time we talked about the rise and the spread of Islam, and you said that early on that Islam providentially served as kind of a check to defective Christianity. How about later? Did it serve any such role? Speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's good to get back into these topics of medieval history. We did have four. If you haven't heard those, let me encourage you to do so. The four particular little podcasts that we had on medieval history, and we're continuing those. And to resume then the subject of Islam, particularly vis-a-vis Christianity, which is what, Jared, I think you were just asking about. I had reflected last time that Islam, as it spread, beginning in 632, especially to 732, as it went throughout, even up into Europe and the Battle of Tours, it was stopped there in France. But there was a great spread in that period. And what happened was Islam often came up against a kind of weak Christianity, and this weak Christianity quite often welcomed it because it saw Islam as a kind of buffer that served over against Orthodox Christianity. In other words, in North Africa, for example, Islam met what's called a monophysitic Christianity, where Christ, only his deity is understood, his humanity is not properly affirmed. It met that kind of Christianity, the Coptic Christianity, for example, and also a Nestorian Christianity in other places in the Middle East in a lesser degree. And so when it came up against these, you might say, weakened sub-Orthodox forms of Christianity, it tended to keep those in check, you might say. So Islam, we could say, was used as a rod of censure by the Lord providentially to keep defective expressions of the faith in check and to cause the Western faith to develop in ways that it hadn't. We talked, too, about the development of Europe last time and how Islam contributed to that. But in Europe, you get the doctrine of the atonement, the work of Christ develops. And you're going to have, at the time of the Reformation, really the work of the Spirit particularly developing. So we could say this. You asked the question about any further kinds of checks on a defective Christianity. I would say this. As the Western faith grew corrupt. So now we're focusing on the church in Western Europe. And in the late Middle Ages, we're going to see there were some real problems there. Moral and doctrinal decay, but there was particularly problems about the doctrine of salvation that needed to be addressed. And so God raised up reformers. We'll be talking more particularly about that, Lord willing, later on in our next series. But here's the deal. When these reformers were raised up, there was Islam also occupying the attention of the Bishop of Rome and the Holy Roman Emperor. In other words, the Holy Roman Emperor had concerns other than the Protestants with which to deal. So Charles the Fifth of Spain, Charles the First, Holy Roman Emperor, had not only Protestants to deal with, but also Islamic concerns. The Islamists were, as it were, knocking on his door, and he had to really concern himself with that. And when you think of the religious wars that occurred in the 16th and 17th centuries, you can think of the Capel Wars, those initial wars in Switzerland, which were Roman Catholic versus Protestant cantons. Zwingli was killed in one of those. Are the Smalcald Wars really the next set from 1546 to 1555? Those wars were German Protestants versus the Holy Roman Empire. And at first, the Holy Roman Empire, Rome, their forces were prevailing. Ultimately, they came to a kind of stalemate and truce, the Peace of Augsburg, where they have they adopt the famous cuius regio, eius religio, whose region, his religion. So you're going to have Lutheranism officially recognized. So if there's a Lutheran prince or a Landgraf, some more local ruler, you can actually have Lutheranism in that area and Roman Catholicism in another area. But the point of all of this is, had Islam not been present and a real threat and a concern of the Holy Roman Emperor, had he not had that concern, he could have crushed the early Protestantism. So that's a pretty significant thing.
Give us now the reasons for the Crusades, a description of them, and how you, as a church historian, how do you evaluate the Crusades?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a big subject. Let me just say this. The emperor in the East, Alexis I of Byzantium, sent out an appeal for help to Pope Urban II. And so that first crusade starts around 1095. And that first crusade is really to help Christians in the East who are very much under the domination of Islam, and also particularly for the liberation of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. So the original focus is to go to Jerusalem and to liberate it. So we could say the first reason for the Crusades is Pope Urban's response to the Eastern Emperor's cry for help to liberate them from Islam. And then secondly, the diversion of warlike impulses of the knights. The knights were always in Christendom fighting each other. And this gave them an external enemy, not other Christians, but an external enemy that they could go after, so to speak. And frankly, with the knights, the love of adventure was also a factor. You can think of how things were organized. The rule of primogeniture meant that the oldest in a family would get all the land, so that would keep the land of estates intact, and you would inherit the title. Well, what about the second sons, the third sons? Well, a lot of them went on crusades. So did the first sons, but second sons would often become high-ranking military officers. Third sons might become clerics, maybe bishops, they would hope. The point of this being is that this gave something for the nobility to do by way of adventure. And finally, many were enthusiastic for what they saw as a kind of taking of the cross. This is why they're called crusades. Another form of penitential discipline, apart from the monastery. You might say the monastery was a way, we talked about the monastery a bit, that was a way that you could really be sold out. We like to speak in those ways in youth circles in our own time. Radical ministry. And so this is a more virile form of that, you might say, rather than going into the monastery. And they were offered, the popes promised plenary indulgences also to all crusaders, which was quite a thing, meaning even if you act badly, you'll be forgiven and received into heaven. And so, yeah, we could talk about all the particular crusades. Just to say this about them, you could speak about seven and a children's crusade, and you say children's crusade, yeah, that was in 1212, and most of the children were drowned at sea or sold into slavery, slaughtered. It was pretty nasty. The fourth crusade actually ended up sacking Constantinople. So remember, the Eastern Emperor had asked for them to come in. So these Crusades, yes, there was some liberation of Jerusalem. Yes, there was some deliverance, but it wasn't all the glory is for sure. An evaluation of the Crusades? I would just say this in terms of good and bad. The good might be the Crusades could be construed in some ways as a just war to liberate many who were oppressed by Islam and to recover and establish a rule that would be supportive of and not hostile to Christianity. It had beneficial political, economic, and social ramifications for Europe. It reestablished lanes of commerce and transportation to the east. It opened that up. It opened new ones up, providing the basis, really, with this opening back up of trade and this sort of relaxing of the grip that Islam had on so much. It provided, really, for a new middle class that would develop into mercantilism, if you remember that from your history, and early capitalism. So this is all there. I would say the bad would be a continued confusion of the keys that belong to the church and the spiritual ministry of the church and the sword that belongs to the state. And you had a lot of mixing up of that here, of those called by the church on behalf of the church to fight to liberate Christians, insofar as political entities wanted to help liberate other people. That's legitimate. But the church as the church does not have that mission. And I would say this involved a further politicization of the church. You had in the Middle Ages, because the popes were not just rulers in the church. They were also rulers in the state. You gained what were called the papal states. They ruled over these, and they were viewed often and referred to as an Italian prince. The Pope was. So he was seen as both a religious figure and a civil figure. And this only added to that. And also the Crusades were turned against other than Muslims. As we've indicated, they also not only went after those in Constantinople in 1203 and 4, but they went after groups like the Albigenses and the Waldenses. They sort of turned some of this against groups that were outliers or viewed as problematic in the church.
So you've touched a little bit on the confusion of church-state conflicts therein. That's still with us today, as you've expressed in other podcast episodes. Dr. Strange, what's the solution to this?
Yeah, well, I think that's an excellent question. I think the solution is not what you had often in the Middle Ages. It tended to be a zero-sum game, a purely political kind of approach. In other words, the church wins and the state loses, or the state wins and the church loses. Because you had Rome, the Bishop of Rome said, the church is over the state. And this was issued even in, particularly in 1302, you can think of Boniface VIII in his great bull, Unum Sanctum, basically saying the church is over everything. And kings did not tend to really ever agree with this. And they would say, in contradiction to that, no, the state is over the church. And there was what was called, you may recall, our listeners may recall, Caesaropapism. Is what that was, with the Eastern Emperor saying, we're over the church. Or even then in the reformational time, what comes to be called Erastianism, this notion of the church, rather the state being over the church. And the solution is not the state over the church or the church over the state, but properly recognizing that the church and the state and the family and all institutions of society are under God. And have their own proper spheres, have their own proper internal rules of operation. And the church is an essentially spiritual organization, meaning it's not a civil organization like the state. It's not a biological organization like the family. There's all sorts of overlap between these institutions. But the church is a spiritual mission. And when it loses sight of that, all sorts of problems follow.
Well, thank you, Dr. Strange, for joining me today, providing your insights on this complex topic of Islam and the Crusades. What you brought to the table has helped shed light on the historical context, motivations, and the consequences of this significant period in history. So thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Jared.
Next time, Dr. Strange explores the medieval concepts of scholasticism and mysticism. If you enjoyed this episode of MarsCast, please consider subscribing and telling others who might be interested. Also, consider leaving a review. Your thoughts would be greatly appreciated, as they'll help us enhance our content further, because your support allows us to produce engaging content and to build a thoughtful community of lifelong learners and also practitioners. I'm Jared Luchibor. I'm signing off for now. See you in the next episode of MarsCast.